Greetings, I'm Sue, and today is June 8th, 2026, and this is the Washington Post. First article, Israel launched strikes on Iran after Tehran fires barrage of missiles. Tehran's first such strike since a ceasefire was declared in April, along with Israel's response, threatened to further complicate efforts to broker a peace deal aimed at ending the war. Israel said it struck military targets in Iran hours after Tehran fired a barrage of missiles toward the country for the first time since a ceasefire took effect in early April. The exchange of fire threatened to further complicate efforts to broker a lasting peace deal to end the months-long U.S.-Israeli war with Tehran and raise the prospect of a return to open conflict. The Israeli Air Force hit sites in western and central Iran, its military said on social media early Monday local time, without providing further details. Iran's attack on Sunday followed Israeli military strikes on what Israel said were suspected Hezbollah positions in Beirut's southern suburbs earlier in the day. Around 10 p.m. local time Sunday, the Israel Defense Forces said it had identified missiles inbound from Iran. Another barrage was launched soon after, officials said, triggering sirens across the country. The IDF intercepted all incoming missiles from Iran, it said. Israel will respond forcefully, an Israeli official told the Washington Post, speaking on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive matters. The Iranian terror regime made a grave mistake when it chose terror once again, IDF spokesperson Effie Defren said in a statement to the media. He added that IDF will continue to operate across all Lebanon. We will not allow fire toward Israel. Earlier Sunday, President Donald Trump told Axios that he planned to call Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and urge him not to retaliate. I am going to call Bibi right now and tell him not to retaliate. Each of them had their fun. Israel had its strike, and Iran had its strike. We don't need another one, Trump told the outlet. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said it targeted Ramat David Air Base in northern Israel, which it called the source of aggression against southern Lebanon and Beirut's southern suburbs, according to a statement published by the semi-official Tasnim News. Trump told Fox News that he is not happy about Israel striking Beirut suburbs and that the Iranian missile fire towards Israel is certainly not going to help negotiations aimed at ending the war. U.S. and Iranian officials had said in recent weeks that they were close to reaching a peace agreement. What I would suggest to Iran, you've shot your missiles. That's enough. Get back to the table and make a deal, Trump told the network. Defense Minister Israel Katz said last week that the IDF has refrained from powerful strikes in Lebanon's capital, except for targeted assassinations following a U.S. request. He warned then that Israel would strike Dahiya, a southern Beirut suburb where Hezbollah holds sway if Israel's northern communities are targeted. Israel's strikes on Sunday killed 2 and injured 20, according to the Lebanese Ministry of Health. Israel launched the attack days after the announcement of a U.S.-brokered ceasefire deal with Lebanon, a deal that was contingent on Hezbollah ending its attacks. Hezbollah had called the ceasefire agreement a farce, and both sides continued attacks. After Israel's attack on Sunday, Chief Iranian negotiator Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf posted on social media that as a result of the ongoing U.S. naval blockade against Iranian ports and what he alleged was America's green light today for Israel to attack Hezbollah, U.S. and Israeli bases and assets in the region were legitimate targets. Iran launched its retaliatory strikes against Israel hours later. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard said tonight's operation was a warning, and if aggressions are repeated, the responses will be broader and will include all U.S.-Israeli targets in the Middle East, its statement said. Qatam al-Anbiya Central Headquarters, the command center of Iran's armed forces, said in a statement that Iran had previously warned that if crimes continue in the Dahiya district of Beirut, we would strike targets within Israel, according to the semi-official Fars News Agency. If Israel's military expands its attacks on that region or responds to Iran's actions, it will face more crushing and regrettable blows, and destructive attacks will begin against the regime and its supporters, the headquarters said. The Israeli military announced that schools will be canceled across Israel and gatherings will be limited. The attack marked the first time Iran launched attacks towards Israel since the April 8th U.S.-brokered ceasefire, which followed 40 days of strikes between Israel and Iran after the U.S. and Israel launched the war on Iran on February 28th. Iran's Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei and other top Iranian officials were killed in hostilities, and a consortium of human rights groups estimated nearly 1,443 Iran civilians were also killed. Some 20 Israelis were reportedly killed by Iranian missiles. Early Sunday, NBC's Meet the Press aired a Friday interview with Trump in which he detailed the status of the ceasefire negotiations. "I think we're very close," he said. Trump said the U.S. would not lift sanctions on Iran or unfreeze its assets up front as part of any peace deal with Tehran, and would consider doing so only if other conditions were met. "If they behave, if they do a good job, we start talking," Trump told NBC's Kristen Welker in an interview aired Sunday. The question of economic relief for Iran has emerged as a major sticking point as the two sides pursue an agreement to end the war, which began on February 28th, and reopen the Strait of Hormuz. In recent weeks, both sides have signaled they are close on a deal, but one has yet to emerge. An Iranian official who spoke to the Washington Post late last month said an agreed-upon memorandum of understanding that would open the Strait of Hormuz includes a first phase that would unlock $12 billion in frozen Iranian assets and lift the U.S. naval blockade of Iran's ports. CNN and others have reported that Tehran wants an additional $12 billion to be unfrozen in a subsequent phase. At the time, a diplomat familiar with the talks said that Iran's frozen assets would not be released until it begins giving up its highly enriched uranium, a key U.S. demand. Asked by Welker why Iran hasn't agreed to the U.S. ceasefire terms, which include the removal of its highly enriched uranium, Trump said, "Because they're strong. They're proud. There are things they never thought they'd be doing that they're going to have to do. They've got no choice," he added, "and it takes a little while." The Trump administration has made limiting Iran's capacity to build a nuclear weapon a top goal, and Tehran's openness to turning over its enriched uranium is another significant point of contention in the talks. "If a deal is reached," Trump said, "the U.S. will work with Iran using equipment to remove and destroy its highly enriched uranium. If we make a deal that now we're friendly, we'll all go together," he said. "Now, if we don't make a deal, then we're going to take them out militarily, very harshly, and we'll wait until we do that before we go in which case we'll have safety either way." Next article, why most politicians are not calling for data center bans despite voters' anger. Many Americans are furious about the energy-guzzling behemoths that drive artificial intelligence, but politicians in both parties are cautious about backing all-out prohibition. Annette Singh and Annie Kenalongo will vote in November in this midterm battleground with one issue at the top of their minds: data centers. The full-time moms say their fury over the massive computer-filled warehouses has consumed them ever since Amazon Web Services broke ground on a data center site that stretches from the lush playground their kids use close to the elementary school that Singh's child attends. Singh can no longer see deer peeking out from the trees and farmland that used to abut the park, and Kenalongo, her friend, laments that she can now hear the roaring highway from her house. Their opposition to data centers has led Singh to collect signatures at her book club and in her suburban neighborhood for a long-shot ballot initiative to ban them statewide. This campaign is hardly a one-off. Voters across the nation are concerned that the data centers are driving up electricity prices and polluting the air. More than 70% of Americans oppose building the centers in their local area, according to a recent Gallup survey. It affects me personally, said Conolongo, 46, a former teacher. Jeff Bezos, executive chairman of Amazon, owns the Washington Post. The political energy is slowly beginning to catch up to voter anger. Lawmakers in both parties who have touted dissenters as economic boons in their states are backpedaling. Governor Mike DeWine, Republican from Ohio, paused new tax breaks for the centers last month after an independent report estimated that they had cost the state more than $1 billion in lost revenue last year. And Republicans and Democrats running for office say that they want AI companies to offset their electricity usage to tame skyrocketing power bills. But few politicians are embracing grassroots demands for a pause or ban on data center construction, which some on the left see as a missed opportunity for Democrats to distinguish themselves ahead of midterm elections that they hope will hinge on cost of living concerns. Democrats are divided because some trade unions support the centers, which create construction jobs, and because the powerful industry behind them has poured millions into attacking political opponents. Republicans have largely supported the centers, spurred by President Donald Trump's enthusiastic backing, and have only recently been raising concerns as they hear from their enraged base. The data center's footprint encompasses states that are midterm battlegrounds and will be crucial to determining which party controls the House and the Senate next year. Ohio is home to more than 200 data centers, the sixth most of any state, according to data compiled by the industry group Data Center Map. Georgia, Virginia, and Texas host even more of the centers. A handful of progressive leaders, including Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, have pushed legislation to temporarily ban data center construction. Local lawmakers in more than 10 states also introduced bills this year to pause construction. Last week, residents of Monterey Park, California, approved the nation's first permanent ban on data centers, with more than 86% of voters supporting the prohibition. But even Sanders-endorsed candidates in competitive races, including Abdul Al-Sayed in Michigan and Graham Plattner in Maine, have not taken up that mantle. What I don't want to do is inadvertently exit the playing field and then cede the policymaking space to folks who don't want to impose any limitations, Al-Sayed told the Washington Post. On Monday, Sanders called for the creation of a sovereign wealth fund seeded with a 50% tax on AI companies' stock so that Americans would own a piece of the industry. Sanders, in an interview, touted the policy. But I think it's good politics as well, he said. You are tapping into the concerns that the American people have, and you win elections when you do that. Democratic candidates are largely calling for smaller-scale policy interventions, with many saying that the centers should pay for their electricity usage and stop obscuring details of their development from the communities in which they are built. We need to make sure if data centers are going to come here and benefit, you need to bring your own energy. You need to not make all of us pay for it, Amy Acton, the Democrat running for Ohio governor, said in a recent roundtable. Former Senator Sherrod Brown, a Democrat mounting a comeback bid in Ohio, said he was unaware of the push to get a data center ban on the ballot in the state. With data centers, we need to make sure the investors pay for electricity, not the people who live in Zanesville or Coshocton or in Cambridge, he said. The issue animated a May debate among the Democratic candidates running for Michigan's open Senate seat, with Al-Sayed calling artificial intelligence a tsunami coming toward Americans that merits regulations of the same stringency as those governing public utilities. State Senator Mallory McMorrow touted her plan to tax the industry to pay for job training, and Representative Haley Stevens, the most centrist Democrat in the race, said she supported building the centers so long as they pay for their own resources. I'm eager to see Michigan lead on the moonshots of the 21st century, she said. Many Republican candidates previously followed the lead of Trump, who signed an executive order last summer to speed data center construction. But in recent months, more are beginning to respond to grassroots anger. The Republican candidates for governor and Senate in Ohio Vivek Ramaswamy and Senator John Husted, have a history of backing the centers. But both have recently expressed concern about the center's electricity usage and said they should offset it. The goal is to support America's growing technology infrastructure while helping ensure reliable, affordable energy for local residents, Husted said in a statement. The senator joined Trump for a roundtable with technology companies in March to celebrate their leaders signing a pledge to offset their electricity costs. Former Congressman Mike Rogers, the Republican Senate candidate in Michigan, says data centers need to pay for their energy. "We're going to have to grapple with it," said Alex Triantafylou, chair of the Ohio Republican Party, pointing to an uptick in community-level anger on the right. To the activists pushing for sweeping change, the response has not been swift or substantive enough. "The big corporations that have money are donating to both sides, so it's hard for anyone to oppose them," said Conolongo, who is not organized for the moratorium but supports other efforts. AI companies have poured tens of millions of dollars into the midterms, backing pro-AI candidates and working to defeat those who seek to regulate the industries. Many unions, which have considerable leverage in the Democratic Party, also support data centers, which experts say create thousands of short-term construction jobs, but fewer permanent ones. "These are creating good union jobs, both in the construction but also in the keeping them secure and maintaining them," said Tim Berga, president of the Ohio AFL-CIO. In Ohio, 71% of voters said in a recent poll that they support a temporary ban on data centers. Majority said data centers have a bad effect on the environment, energy prices, and the quality of life of people who live near them. In a statement, an Amazon spokesperson said the company is committed to delivering meaningful local benefits to communities and has invested $70 billion in Ohio since 2016. "There are folks that believe that if the Democratic Party would become a party of no data centers, that a Democratic Party could run the table," said Chris Gibbs, chair of the Ohio Democratic Party's Rural Caucus. Gibbs said that would be short-sighted, however, and that the better path is to help communities strike better deals with tech companies so they benefit more financially from the center's presence. "Just to be the party of no all the time, I don't think is good for the Democratic Party's future," Gibbs said. For Singh and Conolongo, the slow-moving debate has been hard to watch. "This area is so great," Singh, 36, a political independent, said of the peaceful Columbus suburb. "I feel like this taints it a little bit, like puts a black spot on it. I'm frustrated," she added. "I want better politicians." Next article. A record die-off of sea stars was followed by something that stunned biologists. The creatures almost went extinct along the West Coast a decade ago. Recently, they have been making a comeback. For much of his career, Bruce Menge assumed he would conduct the same research until he died. The marine biologist has studied sea stars since the 1970s, and the animals had always seemed more solid a bet than others in the ocean. They have no natural enemies, regenerate limbs when they lose them, and reproduce prolifically. Then, just over a decade ago, a mysterious disease wiped out 90% of the West Coast's sea star population. Tide pools emptied, and Menge had no idea what might become of his work. "I was upset," Menge said. "I thought these animals were immortal." Little did he know, some of the biggest and busiest days of his career were still ahead of him. Menge is 82, but he clambered over a mussel bed one windy morning in mid-May faster than any of the biology students working alongside of him. He took a seat in a spot that would soon become part of the Pacific Ocean, and he peered down at something he hadn't seen much of in the decades he'd been coming to this Oregon coast tide pool, a teeny tiny sea star, no bigger than his fingernail. 6 months ago, Menge's team published exciting research. Five-legged sea stars were undergoing a significant baby boom. The tide pools were denser than they had been before the disease, and the juveniles were eating mussels and clearing space for other species. In short, something rare and wonderful was happening on the Oregon coast. One of the intertidal zone's most important predators had returned from the brink. As the oceans warm and species disappear, good news can feel increasingly rare for a biologist to come by. The resurgent, Mange admitted, is pretty cool. But he has no idea why Oregon sea stars rebounded or how long they might live. Scientists are forecasting both a warm summer and an El Nino, either which could spell trouble. And the last decade has taught Mange that disease can take out even the strongest beings. But as Mange scrambled over a barnacle-covered rock this spring, he kept in mind another, more hopeful possibility. These new sea stars were growing despite the continued existence of the disease that killed an earlier generation. If they made it to adulthood, they just might be as resilient and indestructible as Mange once believed their ancestors were. Mange began to notice what came to be called sea star wasting disease in the spring of 2014. He and a team of researchers had been doing what they've done twice a year since the 1990s, measuring and weighing sea stars, when he noticed an unusual development. Mange's research methods are old school. He uses a ruler and a small scale, then notes each star's particulars in pencil. Mange never calls sea stars starfish, even though quite a few great scientists do, because they are not fish. Over the years, his team has compiled one of the most robust data sets in existence on the five-legged ochre sea star, which is known for its tenacious rock clinging and its appetite for mussels. They went back to the same site so often, Mange says he began to recognize individual animals. There was one with a split Y-shaped arm, he said. I weighed that one many times. But in late April 2014, Mange observed that some of the sea stars at his sites had twisted arms. Other had lost their grips on the rocks. Something disturbing and novel was afoot. Mange was disheartened, but he was also a scientist. He began visiting 15 sites down the Oregon coast and into Cape Mendocino, California, some as many as every 2 weeks. Initially, less than 3% of the animals had twisted arms. By late summer, 93% of the sea stars were affected. Eventually, the Pacific Ocean lost billions of sea stars from 20 different species between Alaska and Baja California. Scientists rarely have a chance to chronicle a population crash in real time, and the sea star die-off was the largest known decimation of a marine invertebrate. As he and his team returned to their sites, they noticed trends. After the sea star's arms began to curl, they would develop lesions. Many flattened out like pancakes. Others began to liquefy into a pile of spines called ossicles. Scientists tried out a number of theories. The early days of the disease happened during a marine heat wave and El Nino that also killed off kelp species. Sea stars in the warmest parts of the ocean did suffer more, but others died in cooler waters, so Mange wasn't sure climate warming was the sole reason for the mass extinction. For a while, some scientists thought a densovirus was to blame, something similar to parvo in dogs, but they later found that hypothesis to be wrong. Last summer, after 4 years of studying the sunflower sea star, scientists from Vancouver, British Columbia, and Washington State announced that they had linked the mass extinction to Vibrio pectinicida, a strain of bacteria that once decimated scallops on the East Coast. The researchers told journalists they got chills when they made the discovery. The sunflower sea star is the world's biggest. Some are an entire yard wide and have up to 24 arms. The scientists had all been heartbroken when they died and hoped their findings might lead to a recovery. But a known culprit is not yet a cure. When they published their findings, the scientists also wrote that the sunflower star had never bounced back. For now, the species is functionally extinct along most of the Pacific coast. 3 months later, Mange published a data set born out of all of his note-taking. Yes, wasting disease was still killing the sunflower and other sea stars, but the ochre sea stars that live on the rocks between the tide marks had begun to rebound. In fact, their populations were denser than he had ever seen them. Menge and a team of biology students resumed their studies last month during a series of low tides. The fog was thick and the wind strong in Yakutsk as Menge set up a research station on a rocky slope hidden behind vacation rentals. The team had a MacGyver quality. A field technician used a screwdriver and a Home Depot bucket to collect specimens, and Menge protected his scale with a pop-up tent meant for cats. By 9 a.m., he had a pile of stars. He reached into the tent and set a bright orange one on the scale. It weighed just 11.5 grams, roughly the same as 4 pennies. Before the wasting event, you would almost never see these little guys, he said. The year after the mass extinction, Menge found more babies than he'd ever seen. At some sites, he calculated as much as an 8,100% increase in juvenile density. Menge is still trying to discern what led to the baby boom. One possibility is that the wasting disease triggered the resurgence, similar to the way wildfires spur new forest growth. That initial discovery was exciting, but Menge had no idea if the babies would mature into adults. Sea stars are slow-growing, and he would need years' worth of data to say for certain whether the species was recovering. All morning in Yakutsk, he held up a ruler to stars no longer than a few inches. These were likely a few years old, a sign that was encouraging, if not quite definitive. As Menge weighed and measures, field technician Emma Neal appeared with a heavy bucket. "I come bearing more stars for you," she said. Menge peered in, then pulled out a purple star whose arms were about a half a foot long. "Oh, there's a big one," he said. It weighed nearly a pound. These days, big stars are the novelty. Though the tide pools are rich with sea stars, most remain much smaller than the animals Menge used to see before the outbreak. That can feel thrilling when it comes to cuteness, but troubling for the shore's diversity. The little guys that researchers call recruits can't eat large mussels the way the bigger stars can. That has all sorts of downstream effects. If sea stars don't eat mussels, the mussel blanket intertidal rocks and makes life more difficult for seaweed and other invertebrates. The more sea stars consume, the greater chance other species have to thrive. Still, a decade in, Menge and former postdoctoral students have been able to show that many stars are reaching adulthood, a fact that could indicate that this generation is somehow resistant to the wasting disease. But some of the animals Menge weighed in mid-May had lesions, and he had no idea what the summer might hold. Forecasters believe a super El Niño will bring in elevated temperatures and unusually high tides to the Oregon coast by July. "We are sitting on the edge of our collective seats to see what might happen this year," Menge said. "All I can say is, stay tuned." Next article. Political dynasties carry new baggage as voters vilify the elite. Family names have long given candidates a boost. In the No Kings era, they can also make for an easy attack. If voters were looking purely for politicians with familiar family names, they would have plenty of options in this week's primaries for Maine governor. Angus King III, a Democrat, is looking to follow in the footsteps of his father and namesake, now one of the state's U.S. senators. One of King's opponents, Hannah Pingree, has been campaigning with the endorsement of her mom, Representative Shelley Pingree, Democrat from Maine. And on the other side of the aisle, a field of GOP primary candidates vowing to disrupt the status quo in Augusta includes businessman Jonathan Bush, yes, of that Bush clan. "I know what you're thinking. Not another Bush," he opens one campaign ad, "but hear me out." The candidates attempt to either run as outsiders or establish their own political brands show how much things have changed for politicians who once would have been seen only benefits from running with well-known political last names. Such names have long offered connections, donors, and endorsements, as well as the degree of familiarity of voters who might have supported a parent or grandparent. Yet at a moment when resentment of elites and the establishment has been growing in both parties, the contests in Maine and elsewhere are showing that these family ties can also present significant downsides for NEPO candidates, as they have been dubbed by some rival campaigns. Folks are not as interested in people who feel like the status quo, said Noah Dion, a Democratic strategist. These names are the status quo. Dion, who managed Democrat Andy Kim's successful U.S. Senate campaign against Tammy Murphy, then New Jersey's First Lady, noted that the United States has for decades entertained what he called dynasty politics. The Roosevelts, Clintons, Bushes, and many others have leveraged their famous name to a long history in elected office. Today, Congress has at least a dozen sitting members who followed a parent to Capitol Hill, with even more connected via a sibling, spouse, or grandparent. Yet several statewide and congressional races this year will test whether today's scions can extend that success as rival candidates seek to exploit the growing skepticism among voters. Beau Bay, the 30-year-old Democratic nominee for Indiana Secretary of State, would be the third generation of his family to hold statewide office. His dad, Evan Bay, was at one point one of the six sitting U.S. senators whose mom or dad had also had that job. Bay's primary opponent sought to frame him before his nomination win Saturday as part of a political dynasty discordant with the No Kings era, a point Bay didn't entirely dismiss. Having a well-known dad or granddad can only get you so far, Bay said in an interview. You need to convince people on your own merits that you're the right person for the job. It's worked in some cases so far. In Arizona last year, Representative Adelita Grijalva won a special election race to fill the seat that opened up after the death of her father, Raul Grijalva. This year, political novice Trevor Nels is poised to succeed his identical twin brother, Representative Troy E. Nels, who's a Republican from Texas. One of the most notable test cases this year involves a crowded House race in New York City, where Kennedy heir Jack Schlossberg has emerged as one of the several potential successors to the retiring Representative Jerry Nadler, Democrat. Schlossberg's social media feed, at times satirical, at times provocative, at other times focused on photos of him skateboarding and shirtless, has made the 30-year-old a viral phenomenon in recent years. But he has a thin resume and reported no earned income of his own in 2025 aside from trust fund earnings, prompting Nadler, among others, to bemoan that Schlossberg lacks a record of public accomplishment. Schlossberg's campaign did not respond to a request for comment. In New Hampshire, Democratic House candidate Stephanie Shaheen has sought to preempt such criticism by emphasizing her career as a health care advocate and stressing some disagreements with her mom, Senator Jean Shaheen, Democrat, who is retiring from the Senate next year. The mother-daughter pair made headlines last fall when Jean Shaheen and several other Democratic senators split from their party to end a government shutdown, and Stephanie Shaheen, 52, criticized her for it publicly. Still, in an interview, she characterized her family ties as an asset. I was raised with parents and in a family that really focuses on public service and the belief that government is supposed to work for people, she said. Maine's crowded contests have, to a large extent, become referendums on candidates' outsider credentials. That has led to charges that all three legacy candidates are Nepo babies. Hannah Pingree, 49, has been recounting how she grew up knocking on doors for her mom but then ran herself, becoming the youngest ever female state house speaker in the country and then heading Maine's policy and innovation under office under Governor Janet Mills, Democrat. I'm proud of my mom. I think people really appreciate her ability to stand up to President Trump, she said in an interview last week, but they are looking at my campaign for what I've done and my track record. Jonathan Bush, a health technology entrepreneur whose uncle and cousin both served as president, has been acknowledging his family ties more frequently, but insisting he would still be an outsider in Augusta, the state capital. Two of his rivals in the GOP primary are lobbyists. I'm not getting a lot of advice from the Bush cousins, the 57-year-old told Fox News last week. I've been a business guy. His campaign did not make him available for an interview. King, a moderate who has been criticized online for failing to distinguish himself from his dad, is switching between both tacks. He said he appreciates comparisons to his father, a good public servant, and launched his campaign with an ad declaring, "If you know my dad, you know my values." But he has also emphasized his time as a clean energy entrepreneur and an affordable housing developer. And he stresses that he is a lifelong Democrat, a contrast with his father, an independent who caucuses with Democrats. In an interview, he compared running as the son of a politician to playing hockey as the offspring of Wayne Gretzky. People ask whether it's an advantage. The answer is yes, but you still have to go out there and skate. You still have to go out there and shoot the puck, he said. The name on the back of the jersey doesn't help when you're doing the work. In his view, he would be shaking things up in Augusta, too. People do want change. They do want something different, he said. I am something different. Even, he acknowledged, if he wouldn't be the first Angus King to serve as governor. Next article. Robert Coles, Pulitzer winning psychiatrist who shaped public policy, dies at 97. After encountering civil rights emblem Ruby Bridges, he spent his career documenting the impact of social and political unrest, especially on the young. Robert Coles, an eminent child psychiatrist, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and Harvard professor who came to wide renown documenting social and political unrest and its impact on young people, the poor, and the vulnerable, died June 4th at a hospice center in Lincoln, Massachusetts. He was 97. His son, Michael Coles, confirmed the death. Dr. Coles, described in a 1972 Time magazine cover story as the most influential living psychiatrist in the United States, collected some of the highest honors in American public life. He was the author of more than 50 books, with two entries in his five-volume series, Children of Crisis, sharing the 1973 Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction. For nearly three decades, he was a professor of psychiatry and medical humanities at Harvard University, and he wrote hundreds of articles in scholarly and mainstream publications. He was propelled as an author, scholar, and at times social activist, Dr. Coles said, by his impression of the United States in the 1960s and 70s as a country in the throes of greater suffering and social and political turbulence than at any time since the Depression. He challenged his colleagues in psychiatry to step outside their professional cloister and be witnesses to the messy world of crisis in which he lived. Life is actually lived. Only then, he argued, could psychiatry play a useful role in the roiling social issues of the day. In dwelling too much on the mind, he told Time, the mind would become abstracted from the body, from the neighborhood, from the society, and again, from the everydayness. Because of his research, which involved years-long immersion in the lives of inner-city residents and the rural poor, Dr. Coles often testified before and was consulted by Congress on poverty, hunger, and migrant workers' health. At his peak of prominence in the late 1960s and early 1970s, he was credited with helping shape legislation and national policy. His books were, in large part, oral histories, an approach that differed from that of most academicians. In addition to those of various racial categories, he sought the views of children and adults, liberals and conservatives, employees and managers, and blue and white-collar workers. Letting people voice their own experiences and concerns would lead to more effective social programs, he argued, by injecting humanity into an often sterile policy debate. In one of his studies, Dr. Coles quoted one black woman, only 30, but calling herself old and sick, critical of the welfare system for what she called its patronizing mentality that robbed her of her dignity. They tell you they want to help you, but if you ask me, they want to make you into them and leave you without a cent of yourself to hang on to. Of all of his endeavors, Dr. Coles was best known for the Children of Crisis series. Published between 1967 and 1977, the five books brought journalistic rigor, anthropological research, and psychological insight to an examination of America through the eyes of children. A Boston native with an Ivy League pedigree, Dr. Coles had gone to the South in the late 1950s to fulfill a two-year military obligation as a psychiatrist at Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi. In 1960, one of his regular visits to New Orleans, he happened upon the ugly scene that erupted daily at an elementary school in the city's working-class Ninth Ward after a federal court ordered the school to dismantle its system of racial segregation. Dozens of armed federal marshals were escorting 6-year-old Ruby Bridges through a spitting, screaming mob of white parents as she integrated at an elementary school. Artist and magazine illustrator Norman Rockwell immortalized Bridges' experience almost 4 years later for Look magazine in his cover painting, The Problem We All Live With. Dr. Coles, who had never been exposed to such racial brutality, was so affected by what he had witnessed that he arranged through school officials to talk to the little girl and to her parents. As he later wrote in The Atlantic, he had wanted to know what a child psychiatrist can learn about the feelings, the fears, and hopes of youth in the actual situation of desegregation. Not long after getting to know Bridges, he sought out one of her teachers. She mentioned that the child had paused one morning as she entered the school building and said something to a woman who had spat at her and a man who had shaken his fist in her direction. When Dr. Coles later raised the question with Bridges during one of their conversations over a 2-year period, the first grader told him she had not spoken to the protesters. She said she was talking to God, praying for the people in the street. When he asked her why, she responded, "Don't you think they need praying for?" Can you imagine a child praying for those who threatened to kill her? Dr. Coles later told the Baltimore Sun, "It really got me going. I was wondering what was going on in her mind. Here was this child all alone going through this terrible crisis, and I just thought, God, what is she feeling?" That moment, he said, inspired him to devote his life to trying to find out how children get on in the world. With the encouragement of Jane Hollowell Coles, his future wife and frequent collaborator, Dr. Coles conducted studies of school desegregation while living in cities and towns throughout the South for 4 years. He spent the summer of 1964 in Mississippi and narrowly escaped the dynamiting of a home used by Freedom Summer activists. The Coleses spent days with the children, observing them in their homes, in their schools, and where they played. With a ready supply of crayons and chalk, they invited the children to draw pictures and then encouraged the young artists to talk about what they had drawn. Despite the turmoil they experienced attending newly integrated schools, he found them unexpectedly well-adjusted. They have fewer temper tantrums or troubles in learning. They usually eat and sleep well, he noted in The Atlantic. During the worst heckling of the crowds which surrounded the schools and intimidated many of their classmates, they had the quiet support of their school routine, and they were closer than ever before to their parents. His first book in the Children of Crisis series, A Study of Courage and Fear, published in 1967, featured the story of Bridges and examined the experiences of children, black and white, growing up during school desegregation in the South. Dr. Coles' two 1971 follow-ups, Migrants, Sharecroppers, Mountaineers, about the children of the Southern rural poor, and The South Goes North, about urban slums, collectively brought him the Pulitzer. His final two volumes in the series, both published in 1977, were Eskimos, Chicanos, Indians, and Privileged Ones, The Well-Off and the Rich in America. The latter volume, he once told the New York Times, was sparked by a child who remarked to him, "The rich folks are the ones who decide how poor folks live." Dr. Coles went on to write best-selling books about the moral intelligence and spiritual life of children and their ability, whatever their background, to transcend challenges imposed on them by their environment. He was one of the key creators of a series of serious and humane psychology as applied to social issues, something that had always eluded psychoanalysis and usually self-oriented psychotherapy. Robert H. Abzug, a historian at the University of Texas at Austin, said in a 2023 interview for this obituary. James Clark, author of a forthcoming biography, said Dr. Coles' work, particularly his efforts to understand the roots of social conflict, continues to be relevant in contemporary debates. Coles emphasized the need for clinicians and researchers to respect the subjective experiences of people, said Clark, a former dean of Florida State University's College of Social Work. Coles reflected this openness as he studied the moral lives of ordinary people. Robert Martin Coles was born in Boston on October 12, 1928, the elder of two boys. His father was a steam fitter from England, and his mother, a homemaker, was the Iowa-born daughter of an Episcopal minister. Religious and artistic, she encouraged her sons to read. Robert grew up in the Irish working-class neighborhood of Dorchester and attended Boston Latin School, where he ran track, played tennis, and edited the school's literary magazine. He majored in English at Harvard and had vague notions of becoming a teacher until one of his professors encouraged him to send a junior year paper he had written about William Carlos Williams to the renowned New Jersey poet and physician. Williams scrawled a reply on the back of a prescription form, pretty good for a Harvard student, and encouraged him to visit. In his senior year, Dr. Coles accepted Williams' invitation to accompany him on his house calls to poor and working-class patients. He watched Williams listen to their concerns as he checked their temperature and blood pressure, and he never forgot Williams' admonition to go out and find people in the world that you can help. Dr. Coles graduated from Harvard in 1950 and, thanks in part to a letter of recommendation from Williams, was accepted to Columbia University's medical school. He also volunteered at a Catholic worker house of hospitality for the destitute operated in Manhattan's Bowery by social activist Dorothy Day. He later wrote two books about her. After first studying pediatrics, he shifted his focus to psychiatry and received a medical degree from Columbia in 1954. During residencies, he found he got on well with children, but was not tough enough to even administer shots. The child would cry, he told the Times, and I would try to comfort him, and then I would be fighting back my own tears. He eventually turned to child psychiatry, largely because of his encounter with Bridges, but also through his exposure to the writings of Anna Freud, Sigmund's daughter, a British psychoanalyst who had worked with war-scarred children in London. Dr. Coles' book, Still Hungry in America, published in 1969, with Al Clayton's photographs of families across Appalachia and the Deep South suffering from malnutrition and food insecurity, provided devastating evidence of want in the richest country on earth. He also spent extended periods in coal country and became a prominent advocate for miners suffering from black lung disease. In the course of his fieldwork, Dr. Coles met with radicals, reformers, and political dissenters. The anti-Vietnam War priest, Daniel Berrigan, hid out in the Coles' household in Concord, Massachusetts, while on the run after being convicted of burning draft records. In addition to the Pulitzer, Dr. Coles was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant in 1981, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor in 1998, and the National Humanities Medal in 2001. He contributed articles to The Atlantic, The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, The New Republic, and other publications, and he taught at Duke University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, while also on the faculty at Harvard, where his classes drew hundreds of students. Although his most abiding interest was the formation of character in the young, he also explored topics as disparate as the works of French philosopher Simone Weil and the music of Bruce Springsteen, with whom he had bonded over their shared sympathy for the dispossessed. Dr. Coles and his wife were married for 33 years until her death in 1993. After retiring from Harvard in 2003, he continued living in the longtime family home in Concord, a quick bike ride from Walden Pond. Survivors include three sons, Daniel, Robert, and Michael Coles, and four grandsons. Dr. Coles' unconventional approach to psychiatry and the many books that grew out of his extensive interviews occasionally drew negative reviews. At Harvard, he was sometimes mocked as Robert Never an Unpublished Thought Coles. Some critics accused him of allowing his subjects to go on too long without his authorial reflection and interpretation, of failing to synthesize or evaluate. But he considered listening an undervalued virtue, especially where children were concerned. Allowing them to express their hopes, sorrows, and frustrations, he said, would ultimately improve their lives and society as a whole. I'm afraid I'm not a very good grown-up, he told the Sun. My wife has always felt I'm more comfortable with children than grown-ups. I teach a fourth-grade class in a public school once a week. I teach them my version of art history, and I just love sitting in those little chairs. Next article, Over shared meals, Philadelphians write a recipe for citizenship. Residents talk about immigration, belonging, and what it means to be a good neighbor ahead of America's 250th as an antidote to some Trump policies. The sound of voices speaking various languages bounced around the Catholic school gymnasium like a basketball. The diverse group of Northeast Philadelphia residents, some whose families have been here for generations, others brand new to the country, gathered for dinner to discuss how to unite communities. The conversations, many carried out through interpreters, were designed to coincide with the nation's 250th birthday in a city where immigrants helped build the nation and officials believe they are needed now more than ever. We are here to break bread together at a time when the nation is deeply divided over immigration, diversity, and citizenship, Harris Sokoloff, the event moderator, said as residents dined on food from local Pakistani and Colombian restaurants. Good food leads to good conversation, and we believe what you have to say about being a good neighbor is important. The Breaking Bread, Breaking Barriers dinner is one of 22 community meals scheduled in 7 of Philadelphia's most diverse neighborhoods this year. 100 people from each neighborhood are invited to attend 3 dinners in their area, plus a final event that brings together all 700 participants. The Welcoming Center, a nonprofit that supports Philadelphia's immigrant community, sponsors the events, which are funded by $575,000 in city grants. The events are tied to the July 4th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence in the city, but they are also designed to showcase Philadelphia as an antidote to the Trump administration's immigration policies that have made it harder for both legal and undocumented immigrants to move to the United States. As they watch Immigration and Customs Enforcement step up arrests in U.S. cities, communities in Philadelphia have been on edge. But especially this year, at a time when the city is celebrating its history and heritage, local leaders also want to focus the dialogue around unity instead of division. People at each of the 10 tables at last week's dinner in Northeast Philadelphia were asked to discuss their cultural differences as well as how to construct a Philly-flavored recipe for citizenship. Families from China, Ukraine, Latin America, South Asia, and the U.S. talked about their struggles, being neighborly, and how to help others feel like they belong. Rashad Shafak, 21, who immigrated to Philadelphia from Afghanistan 7 months ago, said he came to dinner to feel closer to the community. "Everything is new to us," he said. Shafak was seated with the Amirzai family, who arrived from Afghanistan last year, and 2 people born in Philadelphia, Jack Tomchuk, 32, and Lisa Cross Shustak, 61. When asked by a moderator to describe being a good citizen, Friva Amirzai, who spoke in Dari through an interpreter, initially thought the question was about the naturalization process. The moderator refocused the question to inquire about Amirzai's neighborhood in Afghanistan. She quickly opened up. "You want to respect each other, have good communication, and keep a clean neighborhood," she said. Shamriz Amirzai, her 19-year-old son, added in English, "It means you need to respect the law." That resonated with Cross Shustak, who is white and works at a local nursing home. She and Shamriz smiled and nodded in agreement that respect for the law and looking out for each other were important traits of good citizens. Anuj Gupta, the Welcoming Center's president, said it can be difficult for strangers to talk about building community and civic engagement, which is why they wanted to use the dinners to spark those conversations. "Food is the primary tool to get people to understand that they have a strong foundation in common with one another," Gupta said. "Once you establish that, you can collectively go into more complicated topics." Gupta said that he envisions Philadelphia becoming a model for other cities trying to create vibrant neighborhoods where people from all different backgrounds look out for one another. "The number of people living in Philadelphia who were born overseas is the highest it has been in almost a century." 25 years ago, Gupta notes, fewer than 6% of Philadelphia residents were foreign-born. Today, about 16% of residents are from other countries and are credited with halting the steep population losses the city experienced during the second half of the 20th century. The influx of new residents transformed sections of the city, creating predominantly Spanish-speaking neighborhoods in North Philadelphia and African enclaves in Southwest Philly. Some neighborhoods, especially Northeast Philadelphia, now ranked as some of the most diverse areas of the country. Students in the city's public school system come from households where about 160 different languages are spoken. The community dinners have been held in a variety of venues where participants can learn about each other's customs. One in West Philadelphia brought residents from several countries and religious backgrounds to a mosque where they shared a meal on the floor. Last week's dinner at St. Martin of Tours Catholic School was the third of four for the 100 guests invited to attend. The first, which was considered a foundation builder, focused on food and how ingredients in ethnic cuisines cross many cultures. At the second, residents talked about being better neighbors, which included lessons on the informal rules of wintertime in the Northeast. Don't take the shoveled parking spot from your neighbor after a snowstorm. As the dinner conversation broadened to become better national citizens, Shafak and others at his table agreed over plates of chicken biryani and beef empanadas that being respectful and kind, picking up litter, and staying away from drugs or excessive alcohol use were traits of good citizens. The next time they meet, they'll be joined hundreds of residents who had similar dinners in their neighborhoods. Suggestions from all those events will be presented during the final dinner in front of Independence Hall on September 17th, Constitution Day and Citizenship Day. Until then, researchers will study the dinners to see if they can serve as a model for building communities in other cities. Kenneth R. Brown, a sociology professor at St. Joseph's University who is leading that research, said he was skeptical going into the project that the dinners could yield logical outcomes. Since then, Brown said he's become more optimistic after seeing participants' desire for building community. "You really do feel like people are clamoring to have their stories shared with each other," said Brown, adding that he suspects residents are seeking human connections in the post-pandemic era. Still, Brown cautions that more people across the country are self-selecting their networks and isolating themselves among those who share similar ethnic, political, or economic traits. "It is not just race, it's age, it's ethnicity, it's class, really, really heavily class," Brown said. "There is not many spaces left where people come together on an even playing field." Ming-Chu Pearl Hun, president of the Northeast Philadelphia Chinese Association, said that she sees that happening in her community. The dinners have inspired her to work to build better relationships with her neighborhood. Beth Wood, the administrator of the Catholic Charities of Philadelphia's Northeast Service Center, said the dinners serve as a bridge for immigrants who want to assimilate but also have a strong desire to hold on to their own cultures, own ethnicities, and belief. But Wood, who is of Italian and Irish descent, said she still wonders whether the events will have a lasting difference. She noticed that many of the native-born residents who attend the dinners already tend to be sympathetic to hardships immigrants often face. "I think we could try harder to get others to attend the dinners that are not as receptive," Wood said. Those who attended last week's dinner were exchanging phone numbers as they got up from their tables. Many also grabbed to-go containers of food to take home, and some said they plan to give it to a neighbor. That's all the time that we have for today. I hope you've enjoyed listening to The Washington Post on the Talking Information Center.